Good morning to all of you. I was sitting right about there, near where Dexter Porter is seated, in May of 1978, before most of you were born, I think. I was a senior in seminary, and it was the senior week, and I would soon graduate. In this very pulpit, from this very pulpit, Dr. David Siemens preached a sermon from the very passage that we read today. And that sermon made such an impact on me, I've remembered it for all these years. I've worked on that passage over the years and made a mental note to myself, someday I will preach from that passage. Well, today is that day. It's been percolating for a while. So here it is. What about him? The backdrop to this is an amazing chapter, chapter 21 of John's Gospel. It's the last chapter of that Gospel, and it is a busy chapter. You might remember that Peter suggests that they all go fishing, and they do. You might remember that they labor all night, and they do, with no effect. You might remember a strange voice came from the shoreline with a strange command, put your nets down on the other side, which, oddly enough, they decided to comply with that. A miraculous catch of fish took place, and they hauled the fish to the shore, massive fish. They were numbered, actually, so amazing was the catch. And so therein begins this chapter of this amazing fishing expedition in which they recognize the Lord, and then Jesus fixes them breakfast. So now that's pretty cool. I've never thought quite how Jesus would grill fish, but I would like to know. My suspicion is it was pretty good stuff, and probably worthy of a YouTube video on how to perfectly grill fish. It is here where, of course, Jesus then asks Peter the famous threefold questions, do you love me? Peter answers three times, I do. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Now, not to get too deeply into the weeds, I just need to take a little sidestep here and make a couple comments. I know that you know that I teach Greek, and it's very important to read Greek, and there are many reasons for learning Greek. Let's just get that established right now, okay? Here, though, there is the irony that it almost is better for you not to know Greek at this point. Don't repeat that in any other setting than right here. I know that some of you are rejoicing inwardly to hear that, but try to contain your joy. Because as it turns out, there's a very wide and deep consensus now that there is really no intended difference at all between these words, agapao and phileo, love and love, and that we're not talking about a higher form of love and a lower form of love, and Jesus is not quizzing Peter with one word and Peter answering with another. If you want to follow up on that thread and kind of settle your hearts on that, I do recommend D.A. Carson's commentary on the Gospel of John, where at that site he gives seven very specific reasons why these two words should be viewed as simply being what you might call in literary alternation with each other, that is, stylistic variation. So the point isn't different Greek words. The point is he asks them three times, and Peter answers three times. The obvious question is, why did Jesus ask him three times? And most people are, and I agree, by and large, there's a rehabilitation going on of Peter here. A few chapters earlier, he has denied Jesus three times. He has distanced himself from Jesus. He has said, I don't know him. He is disaffiliated from Jesus. Now Jesus gives Peter a chance to affiliate and to declare his loyalty to Jesus. In this way, this can be viewed as a merciful act of Jesus that allows there to be reconciliation to the master himself. But on closer examination, there has to be more going on than that, because what we find is that Jesus doesn't simply ask the question and Peter give the answer, do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Each of these times, Jesus pushes on further to basically ask Peter something else or declare something else beyond his affirmation of love, what Jesus does is he specifically calls Peter and commissions Peter in a certain way. So you love me? Then the response from Jesus comes, then feed my sheep. You love me? Yes. Then tend my lambs. You love me? Then nourish my sheep. And these two are likely, this also is likely stylistic variation where Jesus uses different words to get the same idea across of feeding and caring for the flock. Now, caring for the flock can be viewed as a very general term. It's whatever you need to do to care for the flock. It's got 49 different job description items in it, as most pastors know. They're all impossible to fulfill, and then you'll be fired and sent to another church because you can't fulfill the 49th one that they were asking for. But in Scripture, it seems to me that tending the flock and being a shepherd is a little bit more specific. I think it has to do, on one hand, with protecting the flock from wolves and attackers from the outside, and then assuring nourishment of the flock, getting to right pastures, et cetera, that are safe. And I think that actually both of those answer very well to the ministry of teaching. Teaching truth so as to protect against the confusions and the attacks of falsehood, and teaching truth so as to inculcate understandings of truth that can then shape the heart and shape the behavior and shape the attitudes of a person. And so I do view this as a more specific kind of calling. There are many other images of the church that perhaps Jesus could have used, but he uses this image of shepherd and sheep and gives it to Peter. But there's a second specific thing that happens, and that is that not only does Jesus specifically commission him in a certain way, but he tells Peter how he's going to die. How cool is that, maybe? I have often thought that it would be interesting to decide whether or not I want to know how I'm going to die and when. And I have basically backed away from that prayer. Don't think I ever really prayed it. But, you know, it would be a bit of a nuisance to know when you're going to die and how you're going to die. So for whatever reason, Jesus is going to be specific with Peter, and he's going to tell him, it seems that you're going to actually live to be an old man. That in itself would seem to be a bit of an agony. But then he goes on to say, and you're going to stretch out your hands, which seems to be well known as an expression regarding martyrdom. You're going to live a long way, live a long time, and then you're going to die for me. And then Jesus ends those two declarations, the one of the specific calling and the one of the specific fate, and says, follow me. Follow me. For you, Peter, this is what following me will entail. It will entail a specific mission, and it will entail a specific trajectory in your life that will lead in a specific kind of death. Highly specific, I think, to Peter. Well, that's not the end of the matter, because Peter has his own question to ask in reply to this information from Jesus. And his question is really the title of this sermon, and his question is really what arrested me when I was sitting there many years ago. Peter's question was, as he spun around to point to the beloved disciple, what about him? What about him? Jesus has a very curt answer to that. I think it's a sharp answer. I think it's a blunt answer. And it shuts Peter down. And the answer is, what is that to you? What is that to you? I can tell you that when I was sitting in that pew over there many years ago, I didn't know where I was headed. I wasn't perfectly sure what my gifts were. But many of my peers, they knew where they were headed. They knew what their gifts were. They had their dreams identified, and I felt lost, and I felt, at sea a bit. And I found myself oftentimes thinking, well, Lord, what are you calling me to? I have no idea. I have no idea where I'm going to go. And I'm looking at that person and this person and him and her and them. And not good things happen when that takes place. We find ourselves focused on other people. I think also that we see this if we revisit the question that Jesus asked him. This is often kind of forgotten, but Jesus didn't just ask, do you love me? He said, do you love me more than these? Now, another reference to Greek, I don't apologize for this one, and that is that there's ambiguity there, and you can unpack that three different ways. Do you love me more than these things? Fishing, my former life, boats, etc. You can read it as, do you love me more than you love these people here? Or you can read it, do you love me more than these other disciples love me? And for a long time, I thought it was just basically a coin toss as to where you go with that, until I began really working with it more carefully. And I'll tell you where I've come down to conclude. I've concluded it is the third of these options. Do you love me more than these other disciples love me? One of the reasons I think that is the question that Jesus was driving at Peter is that the whole Gospel of John, not even mentioning the synoptics, is full of events and scenes in which Peter is distinguishing himself from all the other disciples in his zeal, in his loyalty, in his convictions. Oh, he's braver than the others. He's more zealous than the others. He runs faster than the others. And even in this 21st chapter, they run to the tomb, and even though the other disciple gets there first, it's Peter who says, I'm going on in there. Right on into the cave of death. I'm going right on in there. It is Peter who says, let's go fishing. It is Peter who, when the news comes that must be Jesus on the shore, he's the one who plunges in and swims into Jesus. The other disciples are left to struggle with the boat and the catch to bring all that. He's off with Jesus, you know. And then when it comes time to, for this actual time when Jesus decides to take Peter aside and asks, do you love me more than these? I think that what Jesus is doing is putting his finger on a very, very deep part of Peter's heart. And revealing, I think, that Peter not only has certain virtues like zeal and loyalty and fearlessness, which in and of themselves are fine and dandy things to have and be, but it seems that this one little reply question that Peter has exposes a far deeper rift in his heart, and that is that it's possible to have all of these virtues in comparison with other people. I am braver than they are. I am zealous, more so than they are. I am more loyal than they are. Oh, others may run and turn and run. I will be with you all the time. I will not leave you, Jesus. And so what we find is that it is altogether possible and quite likely that in such a simple question that Peter asks, there is a revelation that is rather devastating, and that what Peter is revealing here is a divided heart and mind. The chameleon, I don't know if you've seen pictures of those things. I know they're custom, where I think of them as being able to change color, long, curious tail. But the other feature that they have that's just a bit eerie, you might know this. Yes, they have two eyes, but they have bulging eyeballs. And these eyes can actually move independently of each other and track two different objects. One eyeball can look over here and see something over there, let's say a nice, moist, tender fly. And that eyeball can go right over there and focus on that while keeping focus on you and move around in different ways. I think that what we have with Peter is a case of chameleon eyes. He's got one eye focused on Jesus. I love you, I love you, I love you, I'll serve you, I'll serve you, I'll serve you. And the other eye, he's looking around. What about him? What about them? Why have you taken them there? How does that work? Etc. In other words, I think what is being revealed here is an unholy preoccupation underneath everything of comparing himself with others in order to secure his own identity, in order to secure his own value, in order to establish his own significance. I take this not to be the difficulty of a few human beings every now and then. I kind of take this to be kind of where we all begin. This is how we figure out who we are. We start on the playground, if not earlier. We start by figuring out who we are by virtue of comparing, contrasting with others. And this then moves right on in. Yes, in all other dimensions of life, I think. And when this thing gets going, we can call it pride. And when it gets really going, eventually it ends in, and I've written down 7 D words, and I like this very much, and I'm going to read them because I like the list I've come up with. We eventually become distracted and distraught and distressed over what about him, what about her, what about them. We become disillusioned, we become discouraged and despondent, and then we become thoroughly dejected. One of the problems in finding our value and finding our place by comparing ourselves and measuring ourselves against others, that the goalposts keep moving. I think I find some success vis-a-vis her, and then some other her shows up. Or with him, and then some other him shows up. It's particularly pernicious in Christian ministry and maybe pastoral calling. I don't know. I suspect every form of Christian ministry faces this challenge for ministers. With whom will I compare myself, and will I even begin drinking that poison? We look at other people, we look at other congregations, other places, other ministry foci. We compare salaries. Many people, it's a question of notoriety. And a complaint emerges, a complaint about the other person. But guess what the complaint ultimately is about? It's ultimately about God. Why do you have me here? Why have you given me this set of gifts and not his or her set of gifts? And it becomes destructive. Yesterday at the faculty lunch table, now there is no official faculty lunch table. You need to know that. But I also need to include under my breath that if you show up there, you will feel awkward because it is our table. And I'm also going to tell you that we don't always talk deep stuff. I see Ellen Marmon back there. She is the ringleader of chaos at that table, and if you are feeling down, then you need to come round to our table. You do need, and Dr. Marmon will, of course, lift your spirits perfectly acceptably. She will do that. But there is sometimes, on occasion, wisdom that we share with each other. And yesterday, the conversation was about how many thousands of pastors are leaving their pastoral charges every single year. Thousands. And I know there are many reasons, and there are many fine surveys and studies done, and the reasons are many, and the explanations are complex, and I don't mean to minimize or diminish any of that. I just want to add in that I think this issue is a significant one. Whatever the numbers are, I know it's a significant issue, because I think I experienced it for decades myself. And I'm sure that all of us in the room have battled with this very thing. And I'm sure that despondency and discouragement often come to our hearts and minds. We want to live somebody else's ministry. We want to serve in somebody else's church. We want to have somebody else's pasture and somebody else's sheep, actually, in a certain way. Often I had wondered and puzzled over the list of gifts that we find in Romans 12. And Paul lists the gifts, and then after each one, he has a little comment. And there was, in the middle of that list, the central third of them, he mentions serving, teaching, and exhortation. And it's, to me, very interesting what he says about each of those. And it sounds unnecessarily and totally redundant. He said, if your gift is serving, then serve. If your gift is exhorting, exhort. If your gift is teaching, teach. And I remember thinking through that, that's so obvious, so simple. I don't know what's going on. He's wasted an opportunity here, Paul has, to like unpack the innards of what each of these gifts might be. And no, I think what he's tapping on is that many servers wish they were exhorting. Many exhorters wish they were serving. Many teachers wish they were serving. And back and forth we go, chasing around. And I think what Paul is saying is, it's not some kind of a strict, you can't ever do two things at once. It's not that kind of thing. But as one discerns one's gifting, that is from God. And we find twice, once in 1 Corinthians and here in Romans, that it's God's decision how we're gifted. And this means that part of accepting this call to follow Jesus is to accept that gifting. However much we might inwardly be revolting against that, somehow come to terms with who we are as we've been made and as we've been graced by Jesus. It was about 20 years ago that I, through a mutual friend, was introduced to Wendell Berry. I don't know how many of you know him, but he has often been called Kentucky's prophet or Kentucky's sage or Kentucky's conscience. He's written poetry and novels. He's also written some essays. I think they're really, really incisive essays. And in those essays, that's where I kind of got hooked into reading him. It came about that I was able to sit with him, Wendell Berry, in his living room up there one Sunday afternoon in Henry County. And I wanted to talk about his writing. He wanted to talk about seminaries and preachers. And he said, you know me, he said, I live in the country. I go to a small country church. And he said, let me tell you something. He said, most of our pastors come from, and I'll simply say Seminary X. You don't know what I'm talking about. Seminary X. And he said, they're fresh out of seminary. And he said, they come to us every other year, green as green can be. And he said, we sit there, and he said, and he put it this way, it's very eloquent. He said, I sit in my pew and I try to make eye contact with the preacher. I can't get any eye contact in return. He said, because the preacher is always looking above the congregation, out through the back windows of the church, out past the fields, to the suburban's tall steeples where he really wants to go. It wasn't lost on him. 20, 30 years ago, the sexy positions were the big suburban churches or the nice giant downtown churches well endowed. Now, please give me some leeway here. Don't read too much into this. I think what is sexy has changed. I think very few people want anything to do with some big suburban church. I think the new sexy is exotic ministry. It's wanting to be called to some place where you are serving the most vulnerable, the most disadvantaged, the most difficult population possible. And there you find your value because, again, of where you're serving. And too often, again, please accept an overgeneralization. This is not an accusation. It's the Spirit's job to apply stuff, okay? Not me. But too often it seems to me, and I fear, that we run to these exotic kinds of ministries because it will show up fantastically on Facebook, because we will have many hits in our social media, and because we might be invited to speak somewhere about how we have carved some ministry out of some weird, very difficult place. And we have now basically, without realizing it, been doing a lot of virtue signaling, not really serving those people there. It happens in the professional setting of the seminary here. I'm not just going to point fingers out there. How about here? How about with me? How about with the professor? How about the battles I have fought? Shoot, how many books have I written? I went out yesterday to mow some grass. I think Ben Witherington wrote another book. I got a little letter from the IVP that said that the book that I had co-authored 24 years ago was still in print, and now we'd gone into somewhere around 35,000 volumes sold. I got a grand total of $550 for that whole year in returns and royalties. Craig Keener got that in the last month. Have I been invited on the faculty retreat or on a board retreat to help raise money? Yes. But how much money was raised when I was speaking? Have I been asked to serve on a committee? Yeah. But have I been asked to chair an important committee? Have I been invited to be a speaker or have been given awards? I actually have received Speaker of the Year or Teacher of the Year right here in this Estes Chapel, but others have repeatedly received that honor. I feel utterly worthless now, right? And on it goes like this. If we won't get hold of this, it will take us down. It will take you down. Now, sometimes we claim it's a matter of justice and fairness and rightness that we become concerned about where other people are. And I just have these little tests here. If it's obsessing our thinking, we can't get away from it, what other people are doing, that's not a good sign. If it leads me to vices, like gossip, like character assassination, that ain't good. If it leads me to attack people and not approach problems, that's not helpful. If we find ourselves pursuing justice and fairness everywhere we go, and it turns into a pattern. I had an acquaintance who told me, he says, it seems like everywhere I go, I bump into the need to, you know, bring justice to that situation. Thinking, maybe you're the problem. Maybe you're the problem. Not that there's injustice everywhere for you to solve. And then I think that if you discover, and I think we can, if we have absolutely no confidence that God can take care of things, that God sees what's happening, that's not a good sign either. And then one verse I have come to love and use as a challenge to myself, it's found in James 5, you can find it yourself. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Do you realize that that is a very deep test as to where you are with other people? You will discover that until you have gotten onto the better ground of Canaan, we'll say it that way, on into God's deeper grace, there'll be this very deep little tinge of pain when someone else succeeds. And there will be this little tiny deep elation. You won't let it out. You won't go, yay! You won't do that. It'll be a very secret little cry of joy when someone else fails. Why? Because in comparison, we're making ourselves significant. Well, is there a way out? Yes, thankfully, there's a way out. And I think I would begin by just, if you want to see the list, you can get the video, I'm sure, of this and write it down. But here's my list of stuff, six of them. Number one, hear the word of Jesus when he says, what is that to you? There is something about simply hearing the word. Receive that word. Let it echo in the heart and mind. What is that to you? Jesus, I hear your rebuke. I hear you're saying no to that. I hear it. Number two, it's always good to get into the business of repentance and confession. It's hard to get anywhere in the Christian life without being willing to just say out loud to yourself and to God and to others whom we have harmed, this is the truth about me. I have been comparing myself and I have got to get out of it. It is not good, it's not healthy, it's not clean. Number three, this is one that's been particularly helpful for me over the years. Pray for those troublemakers in your life. Pray for the people who are causing the discomfort, who are making you feel discouraged. People you wish were in another congregation. You keep hearing of this. So, you know, a couple good deaths would improve this congregation a whole lot, we sometimes say. Number four, rekindle our trust in God. Many of us are practicing atheists. We're preaching our sermons, we're doing all that, but we don't have any confidence that God knows, that God sees, that God is active, and that God is the one who will be in charge of all this. Nothing escapes him. Number five, re-envision the long-term glory. Jesus said to Peter, he said, as our writer explains, this was the death by which Peter would glorify God. I'm urging us to look at the right now where we are at, wherever you find yourself located, somehow in God's providence. Say, for me to be faithful here is a great glory to God. Even if I'm never known, and even if I die here, it is a great glory to God. And number six, I would say, receive in a fresh way God's love for you. God's love for you. That's a gigantic agenda. That would take a whole sermon. I'm just going to put it this way. God does love you. And he loves you before you've done stuff. He loves us in spite of our sins. He actually truly adores his own creative work at work in us and cherishes who we are. He wants to be with us. He values you. And coming to sense that, coming to feel it, will be an agenda for us not just to work on, but to pray for a visitation of God's inbreaking love into our hearts and minds. I would simply say this, we find that with Jesus in his baptism, before he had done a single miracle, before he had said a single word, the Spirit came from heaven and declared, the voice declared to him, you are my beloved son. And it was out of that belovedness that Jesus did what he did. And then one of my doctoral mentors, Paul Ochtemeyer, pointed out, and in his opinion, that Galatians 2:20 was the taproot of Paul's own self-awareness. I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, life I live in flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me, first person in singular, Greek again, and gave himself for me. Particular knowledge, particular love, particular belovedness down at the taproot of Paul's whole ministry. And so my suggestion to us is, we're going to be taking here at the table. What a beautiful place, what a beautiful way, what a beautiful occasion. He has shown us his love in his gift of himself to us. Here is a place that we can enter in prayer right now. And as you take the bread and as you take the wine, one prayer could be, Father, help me defocus on others, from others. Help me focus completely on you and receive your love, your embrace that will liberate me to be a person for other people. May God bless us all.